Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome to the Politics Guys with your hosts, Jay Parson and Michael Baranowski.
Hi, welcome to the Politics Guys. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. My co-host this week, as always, is Cleveland area attorney and sometime Republican strategist, Jay Carson. Before we start today's show, I want to thank you for listening, posting reviews of the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, and recommending the Politics Guys to your friends. Due to your support, we've seen a big increase in our audience over the last few weeks. And whether you're one of our new listeners or a longtime Politics Guys fan, we'd really appreciate it if you could write a quick review of the show on iTunes or Stitcher, and especially tell your friends about us on social media. Our website, politicsguys.com, that's politicsguys, one word, .com, has all of our episodes as well as links to our iTunes and Stitcher pages. Thanks again for your support. Our top story this week is Tuesday's off-year elections, where Tea Party Republican Matt Bevin trounced Democrat Jack Conaway in the Kentucky gubernatorial race, and Ohio voters decisively rejected marijuana legalization. I thought first we'd talk a little bit about Kentucky. I don't live there anymore, but I still work there, and so that is particularly of interest to me. I don't know, Jay, you at least probably followed it somewhat, even though you're not a Kentuckian.
I did, and also, yeah, and my part of the state is probably as far from Kentucky as you can get, which is not unintentional. But you probably know a lot more details about him. My sense is that, from what I've read, even among the Republican Party, he was not particularly well-liked by a lot of folks.
Yeah, well, he actually ran in gave Mitch McConnell a primary challenge when McConnell was up for re-election, arguing that McConnell was far too liberal, essentially. So that kind of scary to me, because certainly I would say that McConnell is no rhino, but Bevin is definitely a Tea Party conservative, and he's never had any elective office before, but that seems to be less and less of a concern to voters. And this is a big thing for Kentucky, because Kentucky, even though it's a very conservative state, has a history of electing Democrats, at least to the governor. And this is a pretty big break with that. And I think we're going to see some real changes in Kentucky as a result of this.
What is Bevin's background? Where does he come from?
He comes from he's a businessman. And what business I'm kind of I'm kind of shady on right now. I'm not saying his business is shady. I'm sure it's. I'm trying to imply that, certainly, but he's essentially, I guess, my boss now in a way, as I am a state employee. But his big thing is he ran against Obama and Obamacare, as most Republicans in the South, I think, tend to do.
Nothing wrong with that.
Well, yeah, I think there's a lot wrong with that. But in any case, he has pledged to pull Kentucky out of its state-funded or its state-run Obamacare exchange, which actually is one of the most successful ones in the country. And there are a lot of folks on the left who are very concerned that this is going to push a lot of people who got insurance out of insurance. And so I think Matt Bevin's going to be a pretty big disaster for the state of Kentucky, and I'm horribly depressed at that result.
And who was he running against, and what was the final tally? Again, I'm an outsider here, so.
He was running against Jack Conaway, the attorney general, and Conaway in most polls was expected to eke out a narrow victory, and the pollsters were way off because Bevin beat him by, I want to say, something like low double digits. It was a pretty decisive win, and a part of that was turnout. Voter turnout was really, really low in Kentucky. I want to say it was somewhere in the 30s, I think, which is, you know, certainly not.
That's probably par for the course, I'd imagine, for an off-year election.
Yeah,
maybe
low
for gubernatorial, I guess, but.
Yeah, it's 31% of voters turned out. And so, you know, this is where we can take this past Kentucky and make it a national thing, is that Democrats tend to do really horrible in off-year elections, and those are elections ending in odd years where you don't have races for Congress or the presidency, because they just don't come out in the force that Republicans do. And so their issues and their candidates tend to do really horribly, and certainly we see this in Kentucky and in some other issues as well. But Speaking of that, other issues is that one of those other issues is the issue that's in Ohio, was in Ohio at least, marijuana legalization, which again was decisively defeated by the voters. And so, Jay, I know you were following this fairly closely. Well, both of us live in Ohio, so it's an issue concerning both of us.
And I think we even had on their show, did we make our predictions on the show, or did we say that off the air?
I don't know if we did. I know that we, at least off the air, I said that I thought both issue two and issue three would pass, and you disagreed, and you turned out to be right. Your call was right on the money, so congratulations.
Of course I was right. I would say I underestimated. I thought it would be a little bit closer than it was. But to me, I didn't really have many doubts that issue three was going to fail for a couple reasons. First, Ohio voters are at heart conservative on a lot of these type of issues.
I disagree with that, but go ahead. Okay.
No. And let's put it this way. I think maybe the place where you live and a den of pot smokers, I imagine.
Oh, Cincinnati is actually really pretty conservative. I think Cincinnati is in there. Hamilton County is certainly more conservative than that den of liberalism in which you
certainly
live, Cuyahoga County.
I would agree that I think it probably passed fairly heartily in Lakewood where I live.
Yeah.
But there's sometimes amongst us, I don't know if we're ivory tower types, but look, we live in areas and run in circles that are outside of a lot of mainstream Ohio, and there are a whole lot of small town places who say, hell no, we don't want no drugs, and are going to vote against it.
Sure.
So that was the first thing I think that a lot of people underestimated, that there was going to be a natural resistance there. And then the second issue had to do, of course, with how it was structured.
Before we get to the how, I just want to make a point, and we can get into this maybe a little bit, is, I think maybe you're right in the sense that voters tend to be a little more anti-pot legalization. But I think if we looked at citizens in general, then that shifts. And that's, again, ties into that problem that the Democrats have of getting people out in these off-year elections. And so I think that's a huge issue, because if you take a look at Ohio, now turnout was actually pretty good for Ohio. It was like 40-something percent for this election, which was actually a little bit higher than it was for the midterm elections last year. But in presidential elections, that number jumps up to around 70%. So I really think, and this will get into our strategy discussion, I think, that if the responsible Ohio, the group that sponsored this, would have waited until 2016, I think they would have had a lot better shot at making this happen.
Well, and they might still do that.
Yeah.
I think you could also say this was maybe a test run. Ohio had something similar to this with the casino issues, which it parallels in a lot of ways, sort of creates an oligopoly and allowed certain casinos to operate in certain places. And that took a couple shots at the ballot before it finally passed. So it might be a matter of this is a, this was the first trial balloon, and we'll see what happens and try again. But the other piece of this that was problematic, and this is what the no campaign focused on, to the extent there was a no campaign, and maybe it was bigger in your neck of the woods than it was up here.
It's hard for me to say, because thanks to DVRs, I don't have to watch any of the campaign commercials, and I am forever grateful.
But even I'm saying billboards or signs or online, I didn't see much of it up here. And again, I could see if you're a strategist, you want to focus on getting out the no vote in the southern part of the state, which tends to be much more conservative than the Cleveland area.
Right.
So I can't speak for exactly what they did. But you know what? I think next week we can probably get somebody who can speak to that. But that's another story. So there was the oligopoly issue, and I think it's important, if you looked at the returns, some of the places where it was defeated most heartily by the biggest margins were places like Athens County, home of Ohio University.
Okay, I was going to ask you where, because, yeah.
Yeah, and that is, of course, as many people, it is perennially listed as the top party school in the country. but I think it's Playboy that lists them. Anyway, one would have expected, look, if you've lost Athens County on marijuana legalization, My God, you've got no hope.
Right.
And a lot of this, though, and also was Meigs County, which is nearby Athens, and the industry there is largely agricultural, let's say.
Okay.
And I think there was a there's a product often around in Athens, Ohio, that's sort of referred to as Meigs County Gold. So I think you had a lot of resistance from essentially growers. I mean, and the other folks.
Sure. A lot of people resented the idea that the man essentially would be able to come in and set up these monopolies and they'd be
exactly.
shut out. Yeah, because pot growers are not known for
a, a wonderful analogy
that.
Actually to like what the this was sort of the situation the colonists faced in 1773.
Whoa.
When the British essentially were going to enforce a monopoly, oligopoly, saying you can only buy your tea from the East India Tea Company.
Very impressive, Jay. I like this. Exactly. Tying it back into American history. This is great.
All these things. And again, it's there's nothing new under the sun. And I think this is something to think about. And a lot of people think the Boston Tea Party was about taxes on tea, which it sort of was. But it was more the bigger problem was the monopoly, because a lot of the colonists would buy tea from sort of – it was essentially I've lost my word today.
Happens to me all the time. I just stumble along until another word pops in place, and yeah.
I want to say bootleg tea, but from the West Indies.
Right, right.
It's a lot like that. So yeah, people were rejecting the corporatization, just as the colonists rejected the corporatization of their tea in 77, 73. So
to me, the smarter way to have done it would have been, number one, to run it in 2016. Number two, to make it medical marijuana as opposed to full legalization, because there's a lot more public support for that in almost every poll. And third, to take away the monopoly aspect. And I think if a group's able to do all three of those things, that it's going to pass in Ohio.
And would you have done like sort of the medical marijuana on the California model?
Yeah,
which
exactly.
Is sort of the medical marijuana with a wink and a nod.
Well, that's that. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think that would be a path to making it happen. But I think the people who are behind that weren't interested in that. They were interested in making just a ton of money off of this. And it had nothing to do with bringing marijuana to Ohio for, you know, relief of people's whatever aches, pains, and existential angst or something like that. It had to do with them making millions and millions of dollars. And everyone knew that that was what was going on. And it just stunk to high heaven.
Yep.
So.
Yep.
So anyway, I also wanted to mention one final thing. We've mentioned it before, Buddy. Buddy, the marijuana mascot, is, you know, I was thinking, and I mentioned you earlier in the week, I'm not sure who's creepier, Buddy or the Burger King King, but they kind of are right up there in the annals of creepiest mascots. And just you look at them and it makes your skin crawl a little bit, you know?
Right. A friend of mine who worked on the, helped lead the campaign against Issue 3, as soon as Buddy made his first appearance, he posted something on Facebook saying, you know, ladies and gentlemen, this is the new face of the No on 3 campaign.
No kidding. My God. How brain dead.
And again, it seems to have been dreamt up in some sort of hallucinogenic nightmare.
Yeah, I'd say so. Some pot infused. Yeah. You know, before we get off this story, I know we've been on it for a while. I wanted to point out sort of a larger trend that I think is sometimes ignored when we talk about specific elections, but Democrats have just done horribly across the country since Barack Obama became president. If you take a look in 2009, which is the year Obama took office, there were Democratic governors in 28 states. Now there are only, with Bevin's win, there are only going to be Democratic governors in 17 states. And if we look at state legislatures, in 2009, Democrats had full control in 27 of them. Now it's down to 11. So, I mean, it's been on the state level, and where the state level is what really counts in a real way. People don't tend to follow state politics, but a lot of the laws that we live under, that's where they're made. And at the state level, Democrats have just been getting completely wiped out in the last, you know, in the last 8 years. It's been pretty disastrous for them, really.
And I'll add to that misery by saying that it's not only control of a lot of these state legislatures, it is the the margins of control.
Yeah, and they're pretty big in a lot of state legislatures. Yeah, absolutely.
And for example, in Ohio, I know this is in the last election, we're now at the sort of peak Republicanism that we've ever had in the history of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And I think similar states are also like that. And it's also in the conservatism, as you point out with your Governor Bevin, of the candidates being elected.
Right. And I think you're familiar with that old Tip O'Neill phrase, all politics is local. And that used to be, you know, it was a truism. But I think it's much less true today, because if we look and see how candidates are winning, how conservative candidates are winning at the state and local level, so often now it's running against national figures, particularly President Obama, who's a hugely polarizing figure. And I think they're able to use that. And people are, you know, making their local choices based on these national level figures and national level policies. And maybe there's a disconnect there, but it's certainly working as a strategy for Republicans in that level. And so a lot of Democrats are freaked out about this, but I guess I would say that this is kind of a natural thing. We sort of see the pendulum swing back and forth. And I don't expect that to, you know, I don't expect Republicans to have a durable majority at the state level for a generation or anything like that. There are a lot of things that work in the Democrats' favor, like demographics and some other stuff. But this to me is just how the system essentially is supposed to work. When a bunch of people get freaked out by how liberal they see, you know, politics going, well, then they react and there's a conservative backlash and so forth and so on. So, you know, to me, it's all kind of par for the course.
Well, I'd put a little different spin on it and say, keep in mind, when people run for local office, and local, I'll even include, say, governor, they typically rely on the leader of their party to help them out. Either through making appearances. I mean, that's sort of what you do. I mean, the president comes out and campaigns for you in Senate races, in gubernatorial races. In state legislature races, you have the governor or the attorney general or some other, you know, high-ranking state figure come out. And the problem is, if you have sort of a polarizing or unpopular figure at the top, that makes it that much more difficult for the people down ticket to run and to do well. So I don't think it's necessarily just saying, look, I'm mad at Obama, so I'm going to vote for the Republican for my city council seat.
Maybe not. You're right. At that level, I think you're absolutely right. At that kind of local level, there's probably a lot less of that real local level. So, yeah, I think that's a good point.
Yeah, but it affects the ability to really campaign well, because a lot of Democrat candidates have to spend time sort of distancing themselves from Obama of, you know, what will you do if I'm elected? Well, not exactly what that guy will do.
Sure. And to point out, we saw the same thing with President George W. Bush. I mean, when
sure.
He became...
And again, it's an absolute truism that, you know, in off-year elections, the party who does not have the presidency usually does quite well.
Right.
No, the bigger issue for Democrats, again, they keep touting the demographics, and I sort of get that, and I sort of don't, because we'll talk about Republican candidates in a minute and who they are and where they come from. But the bigger problem for Democrats on a lot of state levels and nationwide is the lack of a farm team, because they're not electing these people to state representative offices, state Senate seats. They don't have that farm team to go to for attorney generals, for governors, and then they don't have that farm team to go to for presidential candidates down the road.
So not that it seems to matter as much as it used to, since, this is maybe just only true on the Republican side, that lack of experience actually seems to be a good thing. But I think that's probably more true on the Republican side than on the Democrat side, at least.
Well, it is for now.
Yeah.
But so who's let's talk about someone who's probably your most recent inexperienced politician who's been in the news lately. It's Ben Carson.
Sure, yeah, Ben Carson. Say, Ben Carson had a rough week this week, and right currently he's neck to neck, really, with Donald Trump at the top of the primary polls. Both of them would be first-time elected officials if they did end up winning, God forbid. But a number of media outlets, including the conservative Wall Street Journal, started to question some of the more, I guess you call them, sensational elements of his life story, as Carson has recounted in his books and his speeches. And
right.
Ben was pretty testy about that.
Well, and here's the irony of that, and I don't think the media still gets it. That's almost really been the secret to Trump's success thus far, is, hey, I'm the guy that the media hates.
Right.
The media hates me but can't stop covering me. And that's been the biggest...
Carson's using that in a big way, absolutely.
Yeah.
And after the last debate, Cruz used it. So, yeah, definitely.
But I do want to hit on something that I think is significant, and I will come right out and say it. The media mobilization, it seems, within the last week against Ben Carson is really sort of amazing. I'm more than hesitant to ever presume racial motive. So I want to make clear that I'm not saying
that. Oh, geez. Okay, okay.
No. Because I'm saying I want to make clear I'm not saying
okay.
But there is a conservative black conservative black Republican poses often an existential threat to the media narrative. And when there is a person like that who starts to achieve prominence, and in this case it's Ben Carson, who sort of topped the polls just recently, all of a sudden it's the full court press of taking down him on sort of every possible front. And I think it's, again, I don't want to attribute to race because I think it's more attributable to ideology.
Yeah, I think definitely. I think on both the left and the right, at least the mainstream right, witness the Wall Street Journal report, they see him as someone who would be a disaster as president and someone who has no business running for president. And they're concerned that if this guy would somehow manage to get elected, I don't think they're even concerned about that. I think if they're concerned that if he ends up by some disaster being the nominee, that Hillary Clinton basically walks into the White House. So,
yeah, I think that's probably the Wall Street Journal's bigger concern.
Definitely. But,
I don't think Ben Carson will be the nominee. I don't think even if he was, he certainly wouldn't. I doubt that he would be elected.
I want to point out,
I do want to defend him on a couple fronts and sort of point out some of the media overkill. The first statement came a couple weeks ago where he said something to the effect of, when questioned about his experience, that the Ark was built by amateurs and the Titanic was built by professionals,
which was a joke line, obviously.
Exactly, and that's a joke line. That's a cliche. That's something that has been said for since the Titanic sunk, probably.
Yeah.
But it was very much portrayed as here is, you know, either one, it's Ben Carson with the dog whistle to the religious right by mentioning Noah and the Ark.
Well, a little bit. I mean, come on.
Perhaps
playing to his base, sure.
Or it is a, you know, look how crazy this guy is. He's believing in Noah's Ark and the animals coming two by two, and you can't have this guy president, which I think is really sort of a misrepresentation and sort of blowing up and showing the sort of freak out that you got in some media quarters. Now, again, that was more in the Voxy, Slatey, Salon type place as opposed to the New York Times. But that was the reaction. And then the next one was CNN's reporting last week about allegedly Ben Carson did not beat up some kids 50 years ago. And again, it was a funny thing because when I first heard about the story, I was sitting at lunch in a restaurant and there was a TV on with, you know, I couldn't hear the sound. You just sort of saw them crawl at the bottom. And I was trying to figure out, are they trying to portray that Ben Carson is a horrible bully and so forth and therefore shouldn't be elected? But no, it's quite the opposite. It's because he said in his book that he got into a lot of fights and beat people up when he was a kid. And now they're saying, oh, no, you didn't. Let's prove it. Let's see a victim here.
Right.
That's
pretty difficult to prove either way, certainly. Now, there were some other stories that would seem a little less, seem a little more likely that he may have been stretching the truth. My favorite one, and I'm sure you've heard this one, is that he apparently recounted that he was in this psychology class at Yale where the professor did an experiment and he turned out to be the only honest person in the class and therefore got his picture taken for the Yale Daily News and so forth. And it turns out that not only is there no picture in the Yale Daily News for that year, but that class never actually existed. So the irony about lying about being the only honest person in a class that didn't exist. But, you know, to me, this stuff is just ridiculous. Yeah, it has nothing to do with what sort of a president Ben Carson would be. I think Ben Carson is a nut. I think he has some insane policy ideas. And sure, maybe he's a nut in his private life too, but that totally doesn't matter to me. I don't care if he's smoking dope or if he's, you know, if he stabbed some kid 30, 40 years ago or didn't. To me, that matters not at all. What matters to me is he'd be a policy disaster for this country. And so I can reject him purely on those grounds. And I think everyone else should reject him purely on those grounds without caring about this stuff that the media gets into such a tizzy about.
Well, that's very high-minded of you.
I'm usually very high-minded.
Take that approach there. Yeah, that's
But we should point out that Ben Carson is not going to be the nominee. I mean, there's essentially zero chance of that. Right now, the prediction markets have him at 6% chance of being the nominee. I mean, it's almost certainly at this point, it's going to take a lot for it to not be Rubio, I think. So Ben Carson is having his moment, just like Herman Cain did and some other, Donald Trump did and some other folks. You always see this. The nuts pop up for a little while, then they go back down. But the Republicans are smart enough, I believe, to nominate a reasonably sane candidate who will do a lot better against Hillary Clinton than someone like Ben Carson or Donald Trump would do.
Well, they go back down after when people actually start voting.
Yeah.
I think that's the big thing. And here's something else that I just like to throw out there. I mean, you mentioned that the polls did not predict the Bevin win by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
What polls there were on issue three, at least public polls that were out there, the common, you know, throughout the media was, oh, issue three is going to, you know, sail through. And I think folks ought to realize, look, there's polls and then there's actual real polls.
Right.
And so often the media performed polls or driven polls are done just to sell newspapers or get clicks and really have very little bearing on reality. The internal polls that campaigns do are often really super accurate. And you know, just because the methodology is better, because they're not trying to get a certain outcome, they're looking.
They
want
to know. Yeah, they want to know where they're at, actually. Yeah, and so, and the internal polls that are released tend to be very favorable to the candidate, but that's only because they're not going to release an internal poll that says, "Hey, we're behind by 10 points."
Exactly, and the other thing is, so many of the internal polls really take into account who is likely to vote.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. And I think that is also one of the biggest factors that comes into things of looking at someone who votes once every 3 years versus someone who votes in every election. That can really change your poll. So yeah. I guess that's my other thing is all these polls, and I've said this for 6 months now, that show your Donald Trump's way up. They may or may not be actual legitimate polls. And when people actually start voting, you're going to see a different story. Now, I'm not going to say that Donald Trump hasn't done surprisingly well, that he doesn't have some support out there. What I'm saying is I don't think it is what people say it is.
Definitely, so. Definitely.
And also one more thing. Leading, and when you're the top tier, top person in a field of 10 or so, is much different. It's you could also say, like, look, a good 75% of the Republican Party does not want Donald Trump as its nominee.
Yeah.
And so when the rest of the field thins out, things will change dramatically.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, let's move from elections to actual policy type stuff.
I'm going to look. Ben Carson, also, I want to say the pyramid thing, that's just plain goofy.
Sure. What Carson said that he thought that the pyramids were some sort of a grain storage type thing for Joseph's stored grain there or some such nonsense. Yeah. Okay. Well,
and it's one of those things that, again, this is going to be one of those reasons why you understand that people tend to elect politicians who have some experience.
Yes, I think that's a real good thing.
I would say that his statement about the founding fathers not being experienced, I think maybe he meant to say something different, that, you know, they weren't career politicians or professional politicians. They were other people who did other trades, other businesses, other walks of life, as opposed to what we think of today as the professional politician.
But they had plenty of political experience as opposed to Ben
Carson.
Yes,
exactly. No. They were, most all of them office holders in their state legislatures or
Or had been working in politics in some way for years and years, as opposed to being a neurosurgeon and deciding, hey, it'd be cool if I could be president.
Yes. Well, again, there were plenty of people who were doctors. But again, it's because the pool that you were fishing from back then, it was just sort of the educated folks, and there weren't that many of them.
Yeah.
Who could fill those positions. But I think, again, I think it's a little unfair that people take shots at him for saying that. But the bigger point to me is, because he doesn't have the experience, he says stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
If he had more experience, he would phrase it better. And he could make the same point without looking dumb, or at least opening up the opportunity for someone to attack him for looking dumb.
I don't know that he could make the point that the pyramids, in his view, were used for grain storage without looking dumb. I think that might be actually impossible to do. But anyway.
That's exactly sort of where I'm also going, is because when you're running for president of the United States of America in 2015, what the pyramids were used for is not one of the bigger issues.
No.
But it's one of those
that does go to your sanity.
Is what they call it in the business.
You know, so yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's move off of election and talk about actual policy for a little bit. We still have a few minutes. One big story came up this week is on Friday, President Obama announced that he was rejecting the proposed Keystone XL pipeline, which would have carried around 800,000 barrels a day of carbon-heavy oil from Canada, from Canada's Alberta tar sands to the Gulf Coast. So, go ahead.
Carbon heavy oil.
Yeah, the dirty oil. That stuff that
this
comes.
This is the special carbon heavy.
It's the nasty
really
stuff.
Super
it's the environmentally pretty crappy stuff. So
it's not the really good oil.
It is not the cleaner type of oil to extract. No, absolutely. And so this has kind of been a big deal to environmentalists who cheered the decision. And so I don't know. What did you think about this, Jay?
We'll talk sometime about. I mean. The amount of carbon in oil and so forth, the refining process. But I mean, listen, I am shocked that Obama has decided to do this. This has been a foregone conclusion for like the last, 7 years that Obama would not permit the Keystone pipeline.
Well, the thing is,
I give him a little bit of credit for at least now he's sort of honestly standing by his convictions as opposed to sort of saying like, well, I'm thinking about it. I'm waiting for more information and so forth. This was going to be the decision all along, and he already sort of paid a price for it,
yeah.
Or Mary Landrieu paid a price for it, and others.
It became a big. I mean, it's really again a much ado about nothing thing, in the sense that the State Department has run numerous analyses of this, and they found that essentially this is going to have almost zero long-term impact on jobs, and it's going to have almost zero long-term impact on climate change. And so it's pretty much a nil thing. And the thing that bugs me is that President Obama said pretty much flat out that if the State Department finds that this isn't going to be a significant contributor to climate change, I'm going to let it go through. And the State Department found that, and he basically went back on his word as far as I see it. So I think this is symbolic politics at its worst. And my feeling is that other things being equal, you let the market work in these situations and other things are equal. And President Obama basically threw a bone to his, to his friends in the environmental movement. And I have a problem with that.
Well, good for you. Good for you. I'm on the side that, look, I didn't believe him in the first place. I always thought he was going to veto this proposal. And now, of course, the irony is if someone wants to ship their oil to refineries in the United States, they can do so by truck, which is further, more fossil fuel and more likely to spill and all
now,
that.
I think the theory behind that is that it is, in fact, cheaper and more efficient to ship the oil through a pipeline. And the thinking I've heard from some folks is that by forcing them by shutting down the pipeline before it's built, obviously, and forcing people to do it through truck or rail, that raises the cost and makes it less likely that that oil will be extracted in the first place. So that,
right.
I think, is – and there's a lot of oil there.
And that's,
something like
that's,
around
and that is an outstanding
barrels.
Policy if I want to raise the price of oil. I'd like to raise the price of gasoline. again, that is
– Well, that's another issue, and I think that's actually a very good idea, though I'd want to do it through something like a carbon tax. But again, that's a whole other issue. I think we can both agree that this is an example of symbolic politics. And I don't think you're going to disagree with me that President Obama essentially went back on his word here, at least how I interpret it.
Absolutely. So. Shame on him. And hopefully this situation will get remedied at some point. Because look, as from a larger energy standpoint, policy standpoint, I would much rather rely and exploit the resources we have here in North America than to depend on places that are further east of here.
Yeah, and we're pretty energy independent now, thanks to fracking, whether you like it or not. And so, it's a lot less of an issue, this energy independence issue, than it was even a decade ago. So, but one day we might have to do a longer episode, or maybe a full episode on these energy issues, which at least I think to you and me are pretty interesting. So,
right, and I think we would agree on actually a lot of them.
Probably, yeah. Which is, they'd make for a great podcast, but it'd be fun for us. So anyway, we're running kind of short on time, but there was one other story I wanted to just briefly mention before we end today's podcast, and that is President George H.W. Bush, I think of him as the good Bush, is making news even before the official release of his autobiography on Tuesday, November 10th, which is coincidentally, or maybe not coincidentally, the Marine Corps' 240th birthday.
Congratulations to you as a Marine veteran.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Are you a Marine veteran or are you just always a Marine?
You're always a Marine. It's kind of like being a priest or something like that. So, yeah. But President George H.W. Bush, who I actually liked and voted for, he's 91 now, probably doesn't have a lot of time left. And so in this autobiography, which was written by John Meacham, who's done a number of these big biographies, took some shots at Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld. Basically called them kind of hardliners, too full of swagger. I like to use the term iron ass to describe both of them. And Cheney, of course, responded, well, iron ass sounds like a compliment to me.
Damn right.
basically that his boy was misled by his hawkish, let's invade and bomb everything advisors, essentially.
Yeah. Now, again, I haven't read no one's read the book yet.
It's on my Amazon list. I'm actually pretty interested in reading because George H.W. Bush, an interesting guy, World War II veteran, did a lot of spook stuff with the CIA and so forth. And yeah, I think it's going to be a pretty good biography.
But again, I think there is a vast stylistic difference between George H.W. Bush and the Rumsfelds and the Cheneys. It's again, maybe that's what's coming out. It's
definitely
Kenny Bunkport versus Montana. You know what I mean?
Definitely. I mean, George H.W. Bush represents the old style Republicans, the Eastern establishment type Republicans, the Republicans that I actually remember back in the day voting for, and I felt like I could vote for these guys. And
well, it was more the Chamber of Commerce and country club and blue sport coats and that sort of thing. And I got to tell you, God, I love that stuff.
I mean, those like I said, back then I was a Republican and those were my people. And I felt very comfortable voting for someone like George H.W. Bush, as opposed to someone like Michael Dukakis, who I love his characterization of Dukakis was apparently he called him a midget geek or something like that.
Which was pretty good.
But anyway, Republicans have changed an awful lot since Papa Bush's day. That's for sure.
Well, I disagree with you on all of that.
Well, you're totally wrong, but that's okay. I'm gonna let it go because you have the right to be wrong.
Again, I think it's often more the how it's said rather than what's being said. But it'll be interesting to see the book come out. I'm actually reading John Meacham Meacham's book on your favorite person, Thomas Jefferson, right now.
Oh God. Worst president.
I'll let you know how that turns out.
Yeah,
so.
Thanks. At least he dies in the end. Anyway, I didn't just say that. So, with that, I think we're just about out of time for today. So, that's really it for this week's episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you have any thoughts, comments, or criticisms, we'd love to hear from you. Our email is politicsguys@gmail.com. That's politicsguys@gmail.com. If you're listening to us on iTunes or Stitcher, we'd really appreciate it if you could take a minute to rate the show and write a quick review. The Politics Guys will be back next Sunday. We hope you'll join us.